This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
I've been riding a motorcycle for 52 years. I started having back pain that turned into the knee pain. I couldn't even sit on the motorcycle. I was like, oh man, am I going to have to give up riding bikes? Kaiser Permanente, they decided I needed a hip replacement, so I was going to do it through outpatient surgery. Panned out great. Recovered overnight. Was home by 11 o'clock the next morning. I'm glad I made the choice for Kaiser Permanente. I'm enjoying life.
Every medical case is unique. Kaiser Foundation Health Plan in the Mid-Atlantic States, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
This is the Cubs-related podcast presented by CubsInsider.com. My name is Corey, and I am on solo duty tonight. Brendan is gallivanting around Europe somewhere, which he claims is a work-related trip, so I suppose we will all just have to take him at his word on that one. But he should be back with us on Wednesday, but with the Sunday night game running late, it was a little hard for us to coordinate that with someone overseas. So I will do my best to handle the two-man workload on my own tonight. But again, I'm coming to you on what is still a Sunday night in Los Angeles, where the Cubs drop the finale with the St. Louis Cardinals, but they win the previous two, so overall take 2 of 3 and win the series. As I feel like I've mentioned a few times on here, it does feel like they have a bit of a habit of dropping that finale just so that everybody is kind of left with that bad taste in their mouth from the game on Sunday, rather than being able to, I guess, just solely focus on the 19 runs and 2 wins that the Cubs have in the first 2 games of the series. But such is life. So I will break down those 3 games, and then we will look ahead to the 3 games at Wrigley Field with the Los Angeles Dodgers. And an interesting schedule point that the Cubs are at here, obviously finishing up this series, which was on the road in St. Louis, then back to Chicago for 3 with the Dodgers, then out on the road for 8 at Cincinnati, and then out here to visit me in Los Angeles. I will definitely be at all of those games. And then back home to face the Twins. And this is all a 17-game stretch. I think it's 17, where the Cubs do not have an off day. So the series with the Cardinals starts it, then back home tomorrow or on Monday, depending on when you're listening to this, against the Dodgers, the Reds, the Dodgers again, and then a series with the Twins before an off day on July the 2nd. So an interesting stretch, a lot of travel in a short period of time, but they do get to go home for 3 against the Dodgers here starting on Monday evening, so that is a good thing. But let's jump into this Cardinals series. Again, the Cubs winning 2 of 3, and it started on Friday night. My boy, John Lester improves to 8-2 on the season with 6 innings of 2-run baseball. He allows 5 hits, 1 walk, and 3 strikeouts. The runs against Lester coming on a Marcelo Zuna home run and a Matt Carpenter home run. But the Cubs offense, the story in this one against Michael Wacha, the Cubs taking it to Michael Wacha as they have done in recent memory. They've done a lot of good work against him. And this one no different. In the top of the 3rd, Ian Happ homering to give the Cubs a 1-0 lead. Chris Bryant following later in the inning with a 2-run home run, breaking the longest homerless drought of his career. I know that we talked about this on the last podcast, but there was some, I guess you could call it concern, but at least just some inquisition into what was going on with Chris as far as not hitting as many home runs. Obviously, he has been in the midst of a funk. There was a good article on The Athletic, I think from either Sunday or Saturday, that talked about just how He's being pitched different. He's not seeing as many balls on that inner portion of the plate that we've seen him do well with over the course of his career. And he's also seeing more breaking pitches. So pitchers trying to avoid going in and trying to avoid throwing him fastballs. So it's an adjustment period, and obviously it has not been the best period for Chris, but very good to see him hitting a homer here. And as we've mentioned before, even when he does slump, the overall numbers still look quite good. So he will make the necessary adjustments and be no worse for wear, I am sure of it. In the fourth, one of my favorite plays in baseball, John Lester, sacrifice bunt, brings a run home. This was an interesting one because it wasn't really the best bunt by Lester, but with Baez running on third, Molina went out to field the play. He might have had a play on Javi. I don't know. It just seemed like when he picked up the ball, Javi wasn't exactly, you know, a sure bet to score. But anyway, the last thing I'm going to care about is what Yadier Molina's doing and the decisions he's making. So he decides not to go home, commits an error actually on the throw, allowing Lester to advance. Some good base running there by John. And Ian Happ to go to third, which allowed Albert Almora Jr. to bring him in with a sac fly. So it was 5-0 in the top of the fourth. The Ozuna homer comes in the bottom of the fourth to make it 5-1. And then in the fifth, Kyle Schwarber with a 3-run bomb. And I mean a bomb. I believe that the Cardinals reported it was the third longest homer by a visiting player in the history of that new Busch Stadium. I think that's what it was. But either way, it was an absolute bomb. I think it was 110 miles an hour off the bat. Statcast had it about 440 feet. I think the ballpark at Busch Stadium reported closer to 460. So take your pick there. But it was an absolute moonshot to put the Cubs up 8-1. Addison Russell with a double to make it 9-1. Albert Almora Jr. follows with a double to make it 10-1. And Chris Bryant with a single to make it 11-1. Carpenter, again, homering for the Cardinals in the sixth. Chris Bryant with a sac fly. The Cardinals bringing across three more in the seventh and eighth. And then Chris Jimenez with a sac fly in the top of the ninth to give the Cubs a baker's dozen at 13. The final, 13-5. Again, Lester the win, Michael Wacha the loss, both of them moving their records to 8-2. On Saturday, this was a back-and-forth affair. Kyle Hendricks, again, bitten by the homer bug early in this one with Ozuna homering again, his 10th of the year, scoring Tommy Pham to put the Cardinals up 2-0 early in this one in the bottom of the first. Wilson Contreras would get the Cubs on the board with a single deflected off the glove of first baseman Matt Carpenter to make it 2-1. And then to lead off the fourth inning, Addison Russell with his third homer of the year, which is always good to see. Addison had some good at-bats in this series, certainly on Friday and on Saturday as well, obviously, with the home run. But on Friday, he was 3-for-4 with 2 doubles and went to the opposite field a good bit. Even the one out that he made in that game that was actually turned for a double play was a hard hit line drive to right field. So that's good to see, though we'll talk in a second about Russell on Sunday, which was sort of the opposite direction. But the Cardinals regaining the lead on Saturday in the bottom of the fourth with a Carlos Martinez single, bringing in Dexter Fowler. In the fifth, Kyle Schwarber would tie us up again with a single to center field, scoring Chris Bryant. And then we would go at 3-3 to the top of the seventh, where it was Ian Happ with the game-winning hit, a double down the right field line to score Rizzo. And then in the eighth, Jason Hayward taking a Jordan Hicks fastball and depositing it in the stands. That's something that happened, and continuing the trend of Jason Hayward just sort of looking like a different player than we have seen in a Cubs uniform for the past couple of years. We saw him take a really good swing against Hader, and we see him here taking Jordan Hicks deep. Jordan Hicks, of course, the pitcher who reached, I think, 104, 105 miles an hour with some of his pitches. So a guy coming in throwing absolute gas, and Jason Hayward is able to turn on that and hit it for a home run. So that was a big hit in that game too. Not the game-winning hit, But obviously, putting the Cubs up 6-3 gives them some more breathing room for Brandon Morrow, who does come in and get his 16th save of the season. On Sunday, the Cubs dropped this one. It was a dud for the most part. The Cardinals winning this one 5-0. Jose Quintana was pretty good in this game, going 5 innings, allowing just 4 hits, 2 runs, 2 walks, and 3 strikeouts, though the runs charged to him but allowed by Bass, who came in to relieve him. And, you know, just one of those nights, and something that we've seen, I think, from Quintana before, that it was a really hot night in St. Louis. I believe it was around 95 degrees during most of this game. And it kind of just honestly looked like Quintana got gassed by the time this fifth inning and sixth inning rolled around. He does come out for the sixth, but does not record an out. And obviously that's where the Cardinals get their the first of their runs and the eventual winning runs. So the Cardinals getting their runs in this one, it came on the first run scores on a double play that Yadier Molina grounds into, and then Jerko singles to bring in the second run. Both of these things happening off Bass, but Anthony Bass comes in the sixth to relieve Jose Quintana after a Harrison Bader single and a Tommy Pham single off of Jose Quintana. I think there were a good number of people watching this game who maybe questioned whether Quintana should have been out there for the sixth at all. Pitch count was low, and he had looked really good for most of the game, but it really did look visibly on TV, for me watching it on TV, that he was just maybe hot, tired, and just, you know, kind of exhausted. You know, he obviously hadn't given up a run until that point, and sometimes on a 95-degree night, you just sort of run out of gas, but he did walk 2 in the previous inning, in that fifth inning, so I didn't have a problem with throwing him out there, but I just know that there were some maybe questioning the move to let him go back out there. But again, Bass comes in with 2 runners on. Marcell Ozuna singles on a ground ball to Addison Russell. And this was a contested play. A-Rod pointed it out, and I know that on Twitter and social media there was some good discussion of it. But Addison Russell fields the ball in the hole and decides to throw to first, not getting Ozuna. If Rizzo had caught the ball, I believe they would have gotten the out, but Rizzo had to stretch for it, and it just wasn't able to come up with it. But it did look, according to the replay, that Russell could have turned and thrown to third to get the lead runner, which then obviously potentially changes the complexion of an inning. I never like to say, well, then Yadi still would have grounded into the double play. Who knows what would have happened? But it was a bit of a missed opportunity, let's call it, for Russell. I don't necessarily know that I want to call it a brain fart or a mental error, just because you never know what these guys are thinking there. He's trying to get the one out. Probably could have had it if Rizzo's able to come up with it, but that's, you know, also not Rizzo's fault that the throw isn't great and it's rushed. But the out was there, and Russell didn't take it. Whatever you want to call it, call it what you will, but it didn't help the Cubs that he didn't make the play at third and obviously wasn't able to get the play at first either. So that allows the Cardinal runs to score. Addison Russell would have a throwing error later in this game as well that would allow the fifth run to score. So a forgettable evening for the Cubs in this one, and the offense, again, delivering a bit of a dud as well, going 0-for-6 with runners in scoring position and leaving 8 on base. The Cubs did have chances with this one, getting a few runners on with no outs and not being able to do anything with it. The top of the third, though, is where we'll go just to look at that. Almora led off this inning with a single, and then Baez was hit by a pitch. The Cubs eventually don't score in this one. Quintana tried to bunt them over and failed. Zobrist popped out. Hayward walked, and Chris Bryant struck out to end the inning. But we're going to point there just to mention that Javier Baez, again, was hit by a pitch on his elbow, straight on the elbow. At least it looked like from the replay. He and Joe Maddon all say it is just a contusion on his elbow, so a bruise and nothing to worry about, but they will have an x-ray, I believe, when they get back to Chicago, just to make sure. But Javi saying after the game, I'm good. So from the man himself, he says he's fine. Joe Maddon says he's fine. Hopefully just a bruise. I would imagine he doesn't play tomorrow, though Javi said he wouldn't rule it out. So At the very least, it appears we did avoid some major injury scare, but at least let's wait for that x-ray just to be sure. Always scary when those pitches come high and tight, and Wilson actually took a hit by pitching this one that grazed off of his light blue for Father's Day wristband. And it was just one of those things that the Cubs were being worked high and tight a little bit tonight, and it's just scary when a guy gets hit flush on the elbow like that, because we've seen, you know, you think about even just Justin Turner this past spring, a guy who takes a ball off the wrist and has to miss the first, I think, around 2 months of the season. So anytime a pitch gets high inside like that and makes contact with the player, it's a very scary thing, and it can really change careers around. If it hits the wrong place, it can change seasons around. So good to hear that Baez is okay, and hopefully this is just a bruise. But so we are going to, I think tonight I'm going to sort of just wing it a little bit more than usual. I think rather than sticking to the format that we've been trying, I'm just going to kind of touch on what I want to touch on, since I'm going solo here and don't have anybody to bounce this stuff off of. But we'll take a further look at some of these notes from this Cardinal series and then preview again the series with the Dodgers. But speaking of the Dodgers, that is a good time to mention that buying tickets can be complicated and confusing, but there is a better way to buy with SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to every type of live event. Whether you're searching for a last-minute deal, planning a night out with friends, or need to find the perfect gift, SeatGeek helps you find the best seats at the best prices, fully guaranteed. There's nothing quite like being there in person, and SeatGeek will get you closer to the action for a great value. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone, and it's by far the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. I can be anywhere, and with just a few taps, I can instantly find seats. I actually just used SeatGeek to buy tickets to the aforementioned series at Dodger Stadium next week when the Cubs come to town. They are here for 4 games, and the SeatGeek app made it really easy for me to find tickets for me and my family and friends to see the Chicago Cubs. SeatGeek is designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever. SeatGeek saves you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. And to get you the most bang for your buck, SeatGeek grades every ticket based on value to help you immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Make SeatGeek your go-to app for finding the best deals on every type of ticket, from sports and concerts to comedy and theater. Best of all, our listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code CUBSRELATED today. That's promo code CUBSRELATED for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. I've actually gotten some messages from some of you listeners, you wonderful listeners, who have used that promo and taken advantage of it. So I hope it is helpful and you guys are able to save a little money on tickets. But getting back to this Cardinals series, the only thing that I want to point out further than what we've already talked about a little bit here is just that it's important that they won 2 of 3. I know we kind of joke that the Cubs have a little bit of a habit of dropping that last game, but I do think it sometimes is hard to put that out of your mind, you know, and tonight Russell making a couple bad plays, the offense not showing up at all again against Flaherty, a pitcher that obviously I think you're hoping the Cubs are able to put a better offensive effort in against, and the Cardinals bullpen, which has been terrible all season. But they do win 2 of 3. It's a series on the road. They came off of the off day on Thursday after having been shut out twice against the Brewers and show up and, you know, bust the door down a little bit on offense, at least in the first game, certainly scoring 13 runs. They, I think, certainly had had enough of being shut out at that point, and they came out and proved a point there. But 6 runs on Saturday in a close game that was back and forth with some lead changes, they're able to get that big hit there from Ian Happ, Jason Hayward with some big insurance. And again, a dud on Sunday, but they do take 2 of 3, and as they come out of the series, sitting at 40-28, the Brewers losing 2 of 3 to the Phillies this weekend. So I think all told, a rather successful weekend. You take 2 of 3 on the road before heading back home for 3, and you pick up a game in the process. So with that, the Cubs sitting just a half game behind the Milwaukee Brewers. as we head into this new week. So one thing I do want to update everybody on first and foremost is the Yu Darvish situation. So Yu Darvish has been throwing and working towards getting back in the Cubs rotation. And it sounded like there was a little bit more optimism maybe than the last time we came to you guys about him being back before the All-Star break. I know, I think the last time we talked, it sounded more like they weren't sure and they were at least allowing the possibility that he wouldn't be back. That possibility is still there, but at least in the talking that I heard today, it sounded at least a little more optimistic. They're getting a clearer idea of the timeline as he's able to continue doing things. But the schedule, at least for now, is he will take Monday off, but he is going to throw live BP two hitters on the mound at Wrigley before the Tuesday game with the Dodgers. So where that leaves him as far as his exact timetable as it relates to the All-Star break or just a specific date, I'm not sure. But I would imagine if the live BP goes well and facing hitters for the first time in a while goes well, they would get that rehab stint in soon and hopefully get him back. So, I think one of the main things, obviously, is that he continues to go through these throwing programs and drills, etc., with the days off in between, and he is no worse for wear. He's feeling good. We have not had any setbacks. So that, I think, is something to continue to keep an eye on, but things are progressing. I know that, obviously, with him being the big free agent signing of the offseason, people perhaps hoping to not be playing these games anymore with him, but it's a process, it's going well, and we're just going to have to be patient. But I do want to circle back to that St. Louis series just for a second before we move on from it, and just mention again that Ian Happ, I thought, had a really nice weekend. He only ends up with three hits on the weekend, but a couple of them were really big. That home run on Friday, obviously the first run of the weekend, and with what has been made about the Cubs' lack of power, I mean, and not even what's been made about it. I mean, the numbers have not been there throughout the year for this team as we've maybe been accustomed to or maybe that we were expecting. So obviously nice to see the Cubs get on the board and Happ providing just that, a home run. And then, of course, on Saturday, the double, a big hit. We've seen the Cubs struggle with runners in scoring position, with two outs, with those sort of late clutch situations. And that was one where Ian Happ was able to come through for this team, and it was obviously a big one. There was a really good clip of Yadi after Happ was able to pull that ball down the right field line of just sort of throwing his head in his hands because obviously he knew that that was going to give the Cubs the lead. But I think anytime you're able to do anything that bothers Yadi or Molina that much, you're doing something right. So overall, I think a solid weekend for Ian. And I think, again, just with the way that this offense has struggled at times, like we saw on Sunday, obviously they were not doing that on Friday and Saturday in those games. But just with what has been the hallmark of the losses like Sundays, just really nice to see Ian Happ come through in that situation on Saturday and deliver that clutch hit and, you know, sort of maybe try to boost the offense in that regard. Obviously, it didn't work for Sunday, but just in general. And then Albert Almora having a very strong weekend as well. He gets two starts in this series, going 3-for-5 in that game on Friday with two runs driven in and two runs scored. And then he gets the start on Sunday night in the 7-hole, going 2-for-4 in that one as well. So a very strong weekend from Al. And I think any weekend where you're able to see Ian Happ get some playing time, see Schwarber get some playing time, Hayward get some playing time, and everybody's contributing. So really, on the whole, it was a great weekend for the outfield. I wanted to highlight Al and Happ in particular, but obviously we have the big Hayward homer on Saturday to provide some insurance, and then again, an absolute tank from Kyle Schwarber on Friday night to really open that game wide open and really make the Cubs a little more comfortable in that score, obviously pushing that from 5-1 to 8-1. So a really good weekend for the outfield. And I think there were some other performances to highlight. Rizzo had a nice game on Friday night, going 3-for-3. Brian was 2-for-4 with 4 RBIs on Friday. But I think in particular, you know, we've talked so much, especially dating back to the offseason and spring training, really, about how Joe would manage these guys in the outfield and how, as their performances changed, so would their playing time, et cetera, et cetera. So especially as we're in the midst of this streak with Jason Hayward, especially since he's come off the DL, it's just good to see each one of these guys, again, not necessarily having equal weekends, but doing things that we can highlight. And, you know, Almora had another diving catch tonight. Kyle Schwarber threw another base runner out tonight. So it's just really nice to see, especially with Hayward in the fold, because I think obviously when we had had this conversation going into the year, maybe a month into the year, I don't know that we knew how much he was really going to factor into this. And obviously he's been one of the best hitters on the team for the last, I don't know, month or so. So it's just been very interesting to watch the playing time and the career trajectories of these guys over the course of the year. And so I think on a weekend where we can kind of have a little star next to everybody's name is a really successful one. And again, one of those reasons that we talk about Joe Maddon, and we try to give him the benefit of the doubt when we can, when certain guys aren't in the lineup, because typically what he's doing is working, and the days that he's keeping the guys out of the lineup are obviously designed to prevent them from seeing bad matchups and getting bad results. So I think on the weekends where everything kind of comes together nicely, it's worth taking a moment to stop and realize, you know, that was a really productive weekend from these guys shifting in and out of patrolling these three positions together. And one last thing on this Cardinals series that I wanted to at least bring up was, I mentioned the decision to remove Quintana earlier when I did the recap, but the one thing that specifically I wanted to touch on here was bringing in Anthony Bass to be the one to relieve him. And the reason that I bring that up is because of the situation. So again, Quintana lets the first two guys on with singles, Harrison Bader and Tommy Pham. I think Tommy Pham runs pretty well, but I know Harrison Bader is a speedy guy. So you've got some decent runners here at the very least on the base paths. And with no outs, you go to Anthony Bass. Now, after the game, Joe Maddon didn't want to hear it for people who maybe wanted to see a different reliever there. And he has talked, too, about one strength that you can build in bullpens is trying to have guys ready for any situation. So other than Brandon Morrow, who we know is typically a reserve for saves guy, and he'll probably get used differently down the stretch if games are super important or in the playoffs, but for now, he's pretty much a saves guy, a ninth inning saves guy. But beyond that, basically everybody else, what Joe and Jim Hickey are hoping to accomplish by the time you get through the season here is that you have Brian Dunsing, these guys who are coming up, Hancock, Farrell, Mazzoni, etc., Rosario, and then, of course, the mainstays, Strope, Edwards, Wilson, Cishek, etc. The goal is that all of those guys are comfortable coming in a high-leverage spot in the sixth inning, a high-leverage spot in the eighth inning, a low-leverage spot in the fifth inning, etc. So I think part of his argument here tonight was, I'm getting Anthony Bass into this game because he's put up some good numbers on the year, you know, for the Cubs in this brief stint here. It's only, you know, one outing or whatever, but also in the minors. And we want him to get in these situations so that we know what we have and that he's as prepared as possible for any role he may have to play down the stretch here. The counter argument to this, and I think why it drew the ire of some fans, and I think was at least a puzzling move to analysts as well, was this was a pretty high leverage spot. And I don't know how I feel about Anthony Bass being the one to come in the sixth inning of a nothing-nothing game with, I don't want to say the game on the line, but we've seen from this offense, again, the overall numbers bear out really good, and you saw that on Friday and Saturday. But we have seen, whether, again, you want to call it feast or famine or something cliched like that, which I've used many times myself, the fact of the matter is we have seen this team, when they don't show up, just not show up, right? So we've seen, obviously, this is what, their third time being shut out in five games, even though they win two of those games in the middle. So it's not an uncommon occurrence. Again, Brendan and I have kind of talked a good bit about why we are more concerned with the overall numbers and the fact that they lead the league in so many categories and not necessarily focused on the famine, if you will. But so the reason I brought that up was to say that I do think maybe on the road in the bottom of the sixth inning, you've only got three more opportunities here at the plate left in this game. Nothing game. Maybe this is the game on the line. And when we look at high leverage spots and run expectancy, win expectancy, this kind of felt like a game is on the line kind of moment. If I'm going to quote, I wasn't listening to the radio broadcast tonight, but I would imagine if he hadn't used it already, I would imagine Pat Hughes, this was a classic Pat Hughes turning point kind of moment. And the interesting thing, of course, is obviously the results, which Joe Maddon pointed to, which I thought was weird. Because Joe is typically, as I've noted more than once on here, more of a process over results guy. But he does get that ground ball that we talked about with Russell, where he probably could get Harrison Bader at third, but chooses to throw to first. And then he gets Yadi to ground into a double play. So in theory, if you allow the sort of imagination to say, okay, if Russell does get this runner at third, then Yadi still grounds into that double play. You know, we don't have like a butterfly effect situation there. Then in theory, Bass does his job and, you know, maybe nobody's talking about it. But I think just from a procedural perspective, I do think it's interesting to kind of dig into stuff like this. My personal preference, I would have brought in a different reliever. I know with Moro being kind of locked into the role he is right now. Again, we'll see how that progresses throughout the year, but they've been committed to this from the minute they signed him. So this would be a crazy place to bring in Brandon Morrow, I think, in a regular season game, but perhaps in the playoffs. You know, we saw Aroldis Chapman in 2016 get into some crazy spots. You know, we saw Wade Davis have to do some multi-inning heavy lifting for the Cubs in the playoffs last year. So as the season goes on, maybe Morrow becomes more of an option in the absolute, this is the game-changing moment type scenarios. But I think a game in June after you've won the first two games of the series and your offense is doing nothing anyway, probably not the time to be using those bullets from Brandon Morrow. But I just would have preferred a different reliever here. I think that this felt like an opportunity where the game was going to be on the line. I know you had Strope and Cishek pitch the day before, but Cishek throwing 15 pitches, Strope throwing 13 pitches. I don't know. We've also seen, you know, guys like Randy Rosario have some real success. It just feels like, you know, Anthony Bass has not been up here for very long. He has not had much experience with this team. Again, he gets the job done, but just from a philosophical perspective, I don't know that I love letting the game be on the line there with a guy who is not one of your most trusted relievers. Again, results-wise, Joe's sort of proven right there. Bass does a good job. He gets a couple ground balls, should have been out of the inning probably with no damage and ultimately a clean line for Quintana then, but not the way it works out. Again, just a moment to kind of pause and see if we all agree or disagree there. I don't think it's that big of a deal, but an interesting one. And I wanted to address it just because it did seem to raise some eyebrows in that spot that Bass was the one that was coming into that situation. And that's actually a good transition into something else I at least wanted to bring up, which does not relate to that Cardinals series, but does relate to the bullpen, Brandon Morrow, and the man he replaced, Wade Davis, who, of course, is now the closer of the Colorado Rockies. And I saw it being discussed today, obviously, because Wade Davis blows his save today, a 13-12 loss for the Rockies to the Texas Rangers, where Wade Davis allows four runs on two hits and four walks in just a third of an inning, bringing his season ERA to 4.55, his season FIP to 4.31, and a 5.53 walk rate on the year, which is not good. Brandon Morrow, by contrast, is sitting at a 1.59 ERA, a 2.77 FIP, and a 3.57 walk rate. A lower K rate by a little bit than Wade Davis. Wade Davis at 10.21, Brandon Morrow at 9.93. But I just think it's worth at least stopping to look at this. I know it's only June 18th, so this full recap of these moves and analysis and grades have yet to be written. But at least so far, I think we ought to note that perhaps the Cubs front office made a really good decision here. And again, you don't want to make a conclusion on this just after a few months, but I just thought it was noteworthy given the blown save for Davis today and a particularly bad outing, four walks in one outing for Wade Davis today. So I know that there was much made about this deal or these two deals in the offseason. I think a lot of Cubs fans were excited about having Brandon Morrow, but of course, he doesn't have that pedigree as a closer that Wade Davis has. And of course, Wade Davis was really good for the Chicago Cubs last year. I think we'll all remember that performance in Game 5 of the NLDS against the Nationals, maybe forever, because that was a really special pitching performance from Wade Davis. But it was a move that the Cubs front office decided to make, you know, even knowing that Brandon Morrow had been very heavily used by the Dodgers in the 2017 season. Of course, his crazy performance in the World Series was something we all watched and knew about heading into that offseason. But the Cubs decided to commit to him as their guy, and you know, we learned early on, I think in either spring training or soon after that move, that, you know, from Jed Hoyer, like, this is our guy, he's going to be the closer. And they've been committed to him and making sure that he's healthy and not being overused. And at least right now, it's looking like a really nice decision from the front office. I know I'm certainly on record on this show, I think many times, as saying that obviously the results are the results. Wade Davis was lights out for the Cubs last year. He didn't blow a save until, what was that, late September against the Brewers, that Arcia walk-off, I think it was. It was the Arcia tying home run, and then Travis Shaw, I think, wins that game. Sorry, I don't have my Brewers wins etched in my memory as well as maybe I should, but I thought Wade Davis at times got away with stuff. I thought that he got away with how good his stuff is and just how much he can trust that repertoire. But I thought he left a lot of pitches over the plate, up and over the middle of the plate. His command wasn't great at times. We saw some high pitch innings, some high stress innings from Wade Davis. Again, even though the overall results were really good. So I'm not necessarily surprised. You know, you add in that, obviously, Wade Davis is getting older, and you throw him in Colorado now, where, you know, things get a little dicier. Sometimes you have to change up what you're doing every now and again to make things work at Coors Field. So I, for one, feel really good about the way this has played out. I mean, obviously, Brandon Morrow has better numbers, so obviously I feel good about it. But just because it was something where, you know, the Cubs were letting a guy with a really strong pedigree as a closer, and again, who had racked up a lot of saves for them and some big performances for them in the 2017 season, and they decided to move on from that, and they were confident in that move. And I think Brennan and I were both trustworthy of that move and of this front office, as we usually are. But it's always nice to look and see these results playing out, because this is something that the Cubs have had to go out and get a closer in 2016, of course, for Gleyber Torres, who is tearing up the American League for the New York Yankees right now. And then they trade Jorge Soler for Wade Davis in the 2017 offseason. So this is a position that has seen a lot of turnover and has required a lot of resources to get right. So at least for right now, and you know, the Cubs have Morrow on a multi-year contract, they feel like they're in a pretty good position with a guy who has handled the adjustment to the role well. We know that he has been a valuable asset to some of the other guys in this bullpen, just from a mental perspective and helping guys, you know, maybe get back up on the horse after a bad outing and just have a good sense of attack. And he's provided that. You know, we know that we joked a lot about how Wade Davis was very stoic and robotic. And I think just in that regard, which is I think is a good attitude to have from your closer and just a veteran in the bullpen. And I think just in that regard as well, Brandon Morrow has certainly filled in that kind of serious, let's get the job done guy at the back end of a bullpen, known a lot for its dancing. So I think good to have that guy in the bullpen and to kind of help some of these young guys, especially, you know, we're seeing a lot of these guys shuttling up and down between AAA Iowa. And I'm just very happy with that move so far. And I think that we were happy with the Brandon Morrow portion of it throughout the whole year. And, you know, you don't like to, I'm not rooting for Wade Davis to fail so that the Cubs deal looks better. But again, we scrutinize everything this front office does to such a degree of minutiae that I do think it's always good to stop. And when we do have this evidence of both decisions, and it looks like at least for right now through the first few months of this season that the Cubs really did a good job on both of these decisions. Again, deciding not to give Wade Davis a lengthy multi-year expensive contract to be their closer, and ultimately trusting their research and their instincts and everything that Brandon Morrow could come in and be that guy, and that what he showed for the Dodgers and what he showed for the Dodgers in the World Series and in the playoffs was legit, and that this was a guy worth bringing in and trusting with this role. So I think that is a good place to stop and preview this upcoming series with the Dodgers at Wrigley Field. On Monday night at 7:05 Central Time, it will be right-hander Kenta Maeda against right-hander Tyler Chatwood. On Tuesday, again at 7:05, it will be left-hander Rich Hill, former Cub, making his return from the disabled list. It'll be his first start since May 19th. He, of course, is a left-hander facing a fellow left-hander in Mike Montgomery, looking to keep his strong string of starts intact while he is replacing Yu Darvish in the rotation. And then on Wednesday at 1:20, the finale will be left-hander number 34, John Lester, looking for his ninth win on the season, going up against right-hander Ross Stripling. Stripling has been very good for the Los Angeles Dodgers. He's coming into this game in 66 innings of work with a 6-1 record, a 1.76 ERA, and a 2.40 FIP, a 10.58 K per nine, and a 1.49 walks per nine. So don't ask me how it's happening, but Ross Stripling has been very good for the Los Angeles Dodgers, and certainly their ace so far on the season, with Clayton Kershaw missing a lot of time on the disabled list, Rich Hill also missing time, and those are some exemplary numbers from Ross Stripling. So that'll be an interesting matchup in that Wednesday game, with him going up against John Lester, who again is 8-2 with a 2.28 ERA. So that a matchup of some of the top pitchers in the National League right now. You know, certainly two guys who, amongst others, certainly a certain someone in Washington named Max comes to mind, but a couple guys who, you know, maybe could be competing for that start in the All-Star game in Ross Stripling and John Lester. So the only thing I think that really stood out to me is that this will be an interesting matchup in Monday night's game for Tyler Chatwood. We've obviously seen a wide variety of Tyler Chatwood starts. So in that last one with Milwaukee, he doesn't rely on his fastball as much and cuts the walks down to just 2, but ends up allowing 4 earned runs. So that was just the third time this season that he's walked 2 or fewer, but the run total higher than we've seen in some of the starts where the walk total was higher. I think that start against the Brewers is more in line with what we're looking for. I think the more we can limit that walk total, we'll be better for it. But it just has been odd this year how in the starts that he has been able to mitigate the walks, teams have found another way to beat him. So interesting as always when Tyler Chatwood is on the mound, and Monday night will be no different. But part of the reason I say that it'll be interesting is I think it's a tough matchup for Tyler. And obviously most things are a tough matchup when you can't control your command and you're giving up too many walks. But the Los Angeles Dodgers rate 4th in walk rate in the league, and they have the lowest O-swing rate, so out-of-the-zone swing rate, of any team in the league. So, and I believe we saw this in the playoffs when we played them last year and losing that NLCS to the Dodgers, that this is a team that is not afraid to work high counts. This is not a team that is afraid to take a walk. And this is a team that is going to do their best to minimize how often they are chasing out of the zone and wasting pitches and at-bats. So they are going to take walks, and they're going to make you throw strikes if you're not willing to walk them. So it'll be interesting to see how Chatwood battles that, because he's sort of been fighting some of his own internal battles, that it'll be interesting to see him going up against a team that is very strong in the categories that you would probably think would create a problem for him. So naturally, given the way that the rest of the season has gone for Tyler Chatwood, he'll probably throw a complete game shutout, but we'll see how that goes. Mike Montgomery, obviously someone to watch, and I think Brendan would get mad at me if I didn't bring him up. Obviously, he didn't pitch in the St. Louis series, but he's just been very good for the Cubs in his starts, giving up just three earned runs in 23 and two-thirds innings for a 1.14 ERA in the starts while Yu Darvish has been on the disabled list. It's just me, so I will not get into what's going to happen as we work towards Darvish getting back, but I think that sort of sentiment is what you're looking for here. Montgomery has been very good to the point that we are seeing many beat writers and analysts talking about how there is no way that with him pitching like this, Mike Montgomery leaves this rotation. They don't offer much of an answer as to what that would mean for, you know, probably Tyler Chatwood or a six-man rotation, etc. But I think anytime Montgomery is starting from now until Darvish is healthy, that's the mindset I'm looking at it for. Is he doing anything that would give you an excuse to pull him out of the rotation? And that doesn't mean if he goes five innings and gives up four runs or something like that. Like, he needs to do something. He needs to have a total implosion, I think, right now to make any sort of a case for removing him from the rotation. Because those numbers that I just read, and just the general observations, I think, when you watch him on the mound, he's had a calm presence on the mound. He's been locked in. He's been, emotional when he's been able to get out of things. And he just looks like a guy who is on right now, who has a feel for his pitches, has a feel for what he's doing that is working against batters. He looks like he has some nice chemistry with the catchers, and it just looks good from just a visual perspective, which, you know, again, not to relate everything he does to Tyler Chatwood, but that is in contrast with some of these starts we've seen with Chatwood, where there's frequent mound visits, there's pitches going to the back screen, and sometimes it just does not look like a well-oiled machine. And Mike Montgomery has only been in there for limited time, though, of course, he started for the Cubs in the past. But he just looks very comfortable out there and is giving very strong results. So on Tuesday, when he starts against Rich Hill, that's how I'm looking at this. Is, you know, not is he perfect or, you know, oh my God, Mike Montgomery's been so great. But just he's really done a lot to warrant, I think, continuing to get the ball every fifth day, or if they decide to do six men, 6 day, whatever you want to say. So I'm just curious if we see anything that might change that. And obviously, I hope that's not the case, and I don't anticipate that. But that's kind of how I'm looking at it, because I don't think that there's a specific threshold. You know, he's got to go six innings and give up less than three runs every start, or he's going to go back to the bullpen. Like, I don't think it works like that. I think as long as he's delivering these consistent, strong starts, unless we see something that is a glaring red flag, like this is not a good start or the wheels have fallen off the bus, I think that we're headed towards Mike seeing a lot more starts in this season, or at least he deserves that. So that's what I'm looking for on Tuesday. It'll be interesting too to see how Rich Hill does. I think an interesting night for the offense there, just because Rich Hill has battled blisters. And, you know, he's one of those guys, obviously, remember from when he was with the Cubs, frequent DL trips, frequent injuries, you know, a lot of these lingering little injuries. So it'll be interesting to see how he comes out and pitches, and if there's anything maybe he's doing differently or anything that the Cubs can jump on if he is not 100% back to his normal self. And then, of course, on Wednesday, I already mentioned this, just a very strong matchup. Ross Stripling and John Lester, two guys with very strong overall numbers. Anytime you have a pitching matchup where the highest ERA of the two is under 2.3, which is John Lester's, I think you've got yourself a nice ball game, so that should be a fun one for a Wednesday afternoon at Wrigley Field. Some really good pitching performances likely to come in this series, but hopefully the Cubs offense is feeling more feast than famine, if you will. And at least in this series, as we've seen against the Brewers and the Cardinals, perhaps against the Dodgers, the Cubs can avoid getting shut out in one of the games. But as long as the Cubs can continue to keep winning series, I don't really have much of a problem with anything that is going on here. So I will leave you with that. I hope that my solo run here was acceptable. Again, we don't really look to do it. It was really just a scheduling conflict with Father's Day today and Brendan being in Spain. So obviously we're working with a number of time zone issues as well. But really, regardless, normally we'd like to have a sub co-host or somebody to join me if we're not able to make it work with the regular me and Brendan lineup. But hopefully this was all right and you guys will give me a pass for hosting this one solo. But with that, this has been the Cubs Related Podcast presented by CubsInsider.com. You can find us on Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, iTunes, etc. If you would be so kind as to go into the iTunes store, their ratings and review section, and leave us a 5-star rating with a comment as to what you like about the show. It does help us get seen and get a little more exposure to find more wonderful listeners like you. And other than that, we will come to you on Wednesday after the Cubs and Dodgers finish up their 3-game set. We thank you for listening, and go Cubs!
Our homes today are like little cities full of different interneting boroughs, like the entertainment district in the living room or the virtual fitness center in the garage. And Xfinity Internet keeps it all running smoothly with reliable speed to power all your devices at once. You get coverage around town, from the financial district home office to the spa.
Xfinity Internet keeps your little city humming with reliable speed and coverage. Now that's simple, easy, awesome. Find great offers and value today from Xfinity. Go online or call 1-800-XFINITY to learn more. Restrictions apply.
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in the new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a 4-part series premiering Sunday, June 6th, only on Showtime.